You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
2 years ago, few people outside of Russia had ever heard of Beslan, but now the town has become infamous as a place where hundreds of people, many of them young children, lost their lives in a terror attack on a school. Joining me now is C.J. Chivers, the Moscow correspondent for the New York Times. He's written an article about the events at Beslan for the June issue of Esquire. And also here are the Emmy Award-winning creative team behind 3 Days in September, a documentary film about the Beslan attack. Joe Haldeman is its director, writer, and producer, and Susan Zirinsky is the executive producer. And I'm very pleased to welcome you all to the show. Hello.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you.
Chris, you're in Moscow now. How soon after the hostage-taking did you arrive in Beslan, and how far away is it from Moscow?
It's about 1,000 miles, so it's a few hours to get there by plane and then a car ride. And we arrived on the evening of the attack.
So you knew right away that you were going to go there to cover this because this was a big story.
The attack started a little after 9 o'clock, and I think the word of it moved through the journalist community in Moscow by about 9:25, and we were trying to get tickets by 9:30.
Do you have any idea of why the hostage takers chose school number one and why Beslan and not some other town?
Well, there's a lot of ideas, but not a lot of real clear insight because we don't have any of the surviving terrorists to talk to. There's only one, and he's been, you know, in the Russian custody since the event ended. And
I mean, his trial is winding down.
Pardon me?
His trial is winding down, isn't it?
It should end perhaps any day. Certainly, we think by next week that there will be a verdict and then a sentence.
And do you think, but that hasn't come out in the trial?
It has not. He's claimed not to really know the origins or the thinking behind the attack and saying that he joined this gang in the last days before the attack. And that part of his defense has been that he was not directly involved in the planning and ended up there more or less unknowing that he was going to be participating in such a thing.
But it is apparent why they chose September 1st, isn't it?
It is, because that would be a day when they would be able to collect many hostages and have a large effect. The people of Beslan will generally tell you that the animosity between the Chechens and the Ossetians who live in Beslan has been longstanding, and that the Ossetians are principally Christian and the Chechens are principally Muslim, and they believe that this was an attempt to perhaps inflame some of the old tensions and perhaps to extend the regional war.
Susan, when did you and Joe decide that this might make a good documentary?
Well, the events that occurred were ones that were overwhelming. I actually was sitting in my office in New York and watching several European feeds of some live picture, some tape being played back. And having had a special sort of place in that I had done a documentary with two French filmmakers and a firefighter partner called 9/11 5 years ago, I felt the draw to the story in that it was overwhelming watching the end game here and just things occurring and the children streaming out and the soldiers and the people from the town armed. It was uncontrolled chaos, quite frankly. And you know, at that point at CBS, we began the process of there's a claim sheet almost at CBS, and we put it in and we said we'd like to take on Beslan. And people actually tried to discourage us at CBS. They thought it was too far, too expensive. Europeans will cover it and we'll just pick it up. But we started to do some research, and I called Joe in, who I have traveled with and has served overseas, and we formed a team, and so be it. And we began working it.
But you had to know that you could get some of the on-the-scene footage.
That's right. You know, we knew that there were multiple entities shooting it, which was a big part of our documentary, just collecting everything that was shot, stills and film and video.
And, Joe, you have footage of Shamil Busayev training the hostage takers in a forest. That, where did you get that?
We actually found that on their own website that they put up periodically. The Russians knock it down periodically, but the Chechen rebels and Basayev have a website.
They're proud of it.
And periodically they'll put things on it. And we were monitoring it pretty closely after the events of Beslan as we started making the film. And literally going on to it every day because things would come up and it would get knocked down and literally came upon it one morning and had my wonderful technical people record it as quick as possible before it went away.
Because it did go away within days.
Who is Shamil Basayev and what was his role in the attack?
Chris, you want to take that? Or?
Sure. Shamil was essentially a Chechen separatist. He had lived in Moscow during Soviet times and returned to Chechnya as the Soviet Union collapsed and became involved in the separatist causes there. He started quite quickly with terrorism. He first really became known to the Russians when he hijacked a plane and flew it and directed it and its hostages to Turkey. As the Chechen wars broke out in 94 and then another one in 99, he was a guerrilla commander. Between the two wars in the late 90s, he was high up in the Chechen autonomous government, but essentially was a warlord and was engaged with another terrorist in running some terrorist camps up in the mountains. And he has gradually, step by step, you might say, descended into a darker and darker state of mind and has become really public enemy number one, the most wanted man in Russia.
You wrote in your article, the attack represented a horrifying innovation in human brutality. Now, Susan just said that they're proud of this. Do they not understand that this works against their the world's support for their for what they want? They wanted the withdrawal of Russian troops from Chechnya. There's likely to be less pressure on Russia for that sort of thing if they do something like this.
Well, they are proud of it, but it depends on who you mean when you say they. There clearly is a group very close to Basayev that has tried in its own twisted way to stand by this and justify it. There seems to be within the Chechen separatist movement a deeper understanding that this has completely backfired. It's evaporated whatever support there was for their cause. It's discredited them, and that it's made it very difficult, almost impossible, for them to get an audience.
And CJ, remember, there were stories from within that in some of the people we talked to, and you as well, that there was division and that there were some women that were part of the terrorist group, that they had not been quite knowledgeable about what was being taken, and that, in fact, it was unclear when one of the women actually was blown up, whether she blew herself up as an act of, I'm not going to stand by here, or she was blown up because she was starting to disagree. There was division.
Because she was upset that they were doing this in a school where so many children were at risk?
That's correct. I mean, if you look back, there have been some pretty horrific events in Israel, but this is one of the most dramatic hostage-taking events where so many children were taken. So many children. I mean,
and it is also the bloodiest act of terrorism in Russia's history, and Russia's had terrorist acts in the past.
Well, you know, 331 people died, and it was 186 kids. You know, the theater siege was pretty horrific in Moscow, and much was learned at the theater siege by the terrorists themselves. So when they took school number one, they had everybody put their phones in, and they came back at people again and again.
My guests are Susan Zirinsky and Joe Haldeman, makers of a documentary film called 3 Days in September, which premieres this Thursday, May 25th at 8:30 p.m. On Showtime. And C.J. Chivers, Chris Chivers, whose article The School appears in the June issue of Esquire magazine, the longest article that they have published in many years. Is that because it was impossible to tell the story differently?
I think
I think it's 20
Esquire
years.
I would agree. We wish we probably had more space, but they felt a tremendous commitment to trying to create the space to tell as much of this as we could. And they were behind the story. They provided an opportunity that's very difficult in newspapering to find that kind of length and to do the sort of layout that they did. And that's, I think, just the nature of what happened in Beslan demanded a larger telling than, you know, what they or any other magazine might typically present to its readers.
Actually, it's interesting that the article is published around the same time that this documentary is being released. Is this just coincidence?
It is a coincidence, and the news gods were in our favor as the trial winds down, and it does get attention. I mean, I think one of the things that moved Joe and myself and the team at CBS that produced this for Showtime was that this was a story that had not gotten the coverage. It hit when there was an enormous hurricane about to hit the Florida coast. There was an election happening that was a critical, some critical races. And it just kind of disappeared into the ether. And the tragedy really crossed a line when kids were taken. And I think, you know, our team especially felt very motivated to bring it to a wider audience.
Chris, was it well organized, the attack?
Its opening moments were very well organized. It seemed quite clear that it had been rehearsed, and the footage that CBS has shown, I think, demonstrates some of the rehearsals, which apparently were held in nearby Ingushetia in the week or so before. The teams of terrorists seemed to be broken down to specific tasks and specialties, and it was quite, from the tactical level, thoroughly prepared for. This is one of the things that's made it so difficult to try to investigate, because there's contradictory evidence all over the place. On the one hand, you have someone like Nurpashi Kulayev, the surviving terrorist, insisting that he didn't know that he was taking hostages. But on the other hand, you clearly had a group of terrorists that had rehearsed this, and even down to the extent that the wires from which many of the bombs were suspended were pre-cut to size to go across a basketball court. They seem to know what they're doing, and yet there is some evidence, as also Susan said, that some of them maybe weren't fully informed. So it's there's things that point in both directions and leave us, I think all of us, even after looking at it for 18 months, will tell you that there's still some questions we cannot answer.
Well, there was also the siege of the theater, which was organized by Busayev. So I guess they had been working these things out as a series of terrorist acts. And you suggested earlier that perhaps they're not doing them anymore because this one has backfired on them.
Well, we won't. I don't like to make predictions about Chechnya. I think most of the people who try to predict Chechnya do so at great risk. It's a very, very volatile place, and the surrounding areas have seen an expansion of terrorist acts. It's clear that they have not done something similar since 2004. It's not clear whether that's their choice or because the Russians have stepped up their security and have put a lot more pressure on the terrorists. I mean, these are questions we won't know the answers to for some time.
We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll find out about the reaction of the government and local police officials, and also what it was like to be outside of the school. My guests are C.J. Chivers, whose article, The School, appears in the June issue of Esquire magazine. And also here are Joe Halderman, director, writer, and producer of a film called 3 Days in September. Susan Zirinsky, its executive producer, is also here. That film premieres this Thursday, May 25th at 8:30 p.m. on Showtime. We're back with Joe Halderman and Susan Zirinsky, whose film 3 Days in September is premiering this Thursday, May 25th at 8:30 on Showtime. And C.J. Chivers of the New York Times, the Moscow correspondent for the New York Times, his article, The School, appears in the June issue of Esquire magazine. Joe, you interviewed the only Russian official who was allowed to negotiate with the hostage takers. Why was Ruslan Aushev allowed in?
Oshef's a really interesting character. He was a widely decorated general in the Russian army in the former Soviet Union, fought in Afghanistan and elsewhere, and was highly respected. He is from the neighboring Republic of Ingushetia, and was in fact the president of Ingushetia at one point in his career. He's widely seen in that area as somebody who can sort of talk to everyone, and I think certainly the sensibility was at the time that he's respected by almost all the parties. By the fact that he is an Ingushetian and is a Muslim, had a certain maybe ability to communicate with the terrorists, and I believe there was the hope, and he certainly felt, and he certainly told us that his hope was to try to bridge this gap, which is a very wide gap between the Russians and the Chechens.
But wasn't it impossible? If they were demanding the withdrawal of Russian troops from Chechnya, that was unlikely, wasn't it?
Yeah, in fact, the demands are very interesting. The list of demands from what we've been able to sort of piece together of the nine or so demands that were listed. One of the demands, in fact, was the separation of Chechnya, but for it to remain part of the ruble economy, which that was an interesting demand on the part of the terrorists. You know, the fact of the matter is, Aushev's belief, and I think it's common in hostage negotiators, was, let's just keep talking. Certainly demands can be outrageous and irrational and unreasonable and impossible, but Aushev's feeling was he was making progress. He got those babies out. He got some of those women out. And he really believed that the government should do and say whatever it could to keep the process going.
Now, Chris, were you outside the school all this time?
Yes.
And what did you know? Did you know that these negotiations were going on?
There was a lot of confusing and contradictory information that was circulating at the time. There also was an enormous collection of local residents on the edge of the cordon who were very upset with the government and were in a very emotionally sort of fraught state because the government, they believed, and it turned out were right, had not told them the truth about what was going on. So we knew that the terrorists had asked to see several different officials, and we knew that those officials were not going to see the terrorists. They had refused. And then Aushev arrived, and just as was said, he managed to bridge that gap, and he walked very coolly into the school. We could not see him from our side of the building. The building is E-shaped, so there's no one place you can be and see all of it, which was one of the frustrations. But he went into the school for a period of time, and he came out on Thursday with 26 of the hostages. And he that event on Thursday was taken on, among all of the people who were standing or crouched around the school as really the first hopeful sign.
But it sounds to me like the Russians were really hardlining this whole thing. Do we have any understanding of what their strategy was?
I think that remains rather invisible to all of us to this day. The Russians have conducted three investigations, two parliamentary investigations, which are ongoing, and then an investigation by the prosecutors who have been bringing both this surviving terrorist and three other police officers who are charged with negligence to trial. These investigations have been essentially panned by the people of Beslan as whitewashes, and they have not provided the answers that I think that the bereaved and the survivors would like exactly as to what Russia was doing. We can say at a minimum that there was inordinate confusion, that the Russians had set up several separate command posts inside Beslan, and it's not really clear which command post was doing what and to what extent they were coordinating between themselves. So there were a lot of different conversations going on about a lot of different things, and the result was that very little seemed to get done besides circling the school with troops, and the troops didn't even seem to be very well coordinated with each other.
Well, it was totally chaotic, and also, I mean, the people standing outside the school, which we have in our film, I mean, the Russian officials were saying there were some 300 people in the school, when if you looked at the crowd, the simple just looking at the crowd, everybody in Beslan, you know, had somebody in that school. There were over 1,000 hostages. So from the get-go, there was a lack of trust. And after the event, the Russian authorities didn't cordon off the school, which actually led us to a very interesting piece of videotape. One of the people that went into Beslan for us was a very smart Russian hand, a professor of Soviet studies, a later a CBS correspondent, a man named Jonathan Sanders, who we sent in immediately to kind of just talk to people and see if he could find out what happened. And two teenagers, it may have been more, found a crushed tape in the rubble, you know, just literally there. And they took the tape and they spliced it onto another tape. And what they found was that in the cameras that had been thrown into a pile at the request of the terrorists from the families that had started the day so joyfully, the terrorists themselves picked up this camera and began shooting themselves and documenting it. And Aslan's, you know, whole venture into that school was recorded there. And when he won the release of the mothers with nursing babies, that's on there. And he actually...
So you did a better investigation than the Russian authorities.
Well, the kids said to us, said to Jonathan Sanders, we're giving you this tape because we know you will get it out. If we give it to the Russians, it will never get out.
There's a BBC report today that despite tight security at the trial of Nurpashi Kulayev, the victims have managed to hold up a sign that said, for the blood of the Beslan children, Putin out. So they are blaming Vladimir Putin. Is he responsible? Did he take a little too long to react to the siege?
Well, one thing, we talked to a couple of the Spetsnaz soldiers who were positioned around the school. One was a captain, and of his unit, there was a sniper. And we talked to them a great deal about what they were trying to do and what they wanted to do, what their orders were. One of the things that became very clear when we talked to them was that their orders were really about trying to end the siege and kill terrorists, not rescue hostages. And I believe, after talking to a number of the people in Beslan after the events, I think that's the frustration that many of the families of victims have, that the Russian government didn't do enough to save hostages, that its military action was much more interested in killing terrorists than it was in saving hostages.
Is that the sense in Russia in general, or is this something that is just in Beslan, Chris? Has this hurt Putin at all in the rest of the country?
It's difficult to measure. Putin is quite popular in Russia, and he has, like any politician, dips and rises. His support, though, is pretty strong and broad-based, in my experience, outside of the caucuses. And to the extent that this has had any influence on his ratings, it's really too difficult to tease out.
My guests are C.J. Chivers, who has written an article for the June issue of Esquire magazine called The School, and Joe Haldeman and Susan Zirinsky, who have made a documentary called 3 Days in September, which premieres this Thursday at 8:30 on Showtime. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There are two trials, as you said, Chris. The other one involves three local police officials. What are they accused of?
They're essentially accused of negligence for not taking action in two ways. Initially, there were warnings that the Russian federal government claims to have made to the local government, the local governments in the Caucasus generally, but also to Beslan, to be especially vigilant around the opening of schools because they had some intelligence that indicated that there may be some terrorist acts on those days. The second element of the negligence is that in the first minutes of the siege, that the police station, which is really only a couple hundred meters from the school, did not organize a response against the terrorists as they were herding up the kids, that they were aware that something horrible was happening and that they did not present themselves to try to put a stop to it. The first charge that in the run-up to the school year, they did not take the adequate steps to guard the schools, to man the roads, to do their own local policing, you know, to prevent this from happening, is, in the views of many of the police officers down there, a little bit trumped up, because they say they get these warnings all the time, and you have a situation where the crying wolf would be the way that an additional warning would be received on any given day. They also had been on a very high alert for more than a year, with about 50% of their police officers on duty at all time guarding the police stations, because the guerrillas had attacked police stations in nearby Ingushetia the year before and overrun many of those police stations. So they say they didn't have the manpower because they were basically protecting themselves. On the second charge, they'll say that in hindsight, that is a convenient argument, and it certainly is a powerful one. But in the immediate minutes where you had more than 1,000 people corralled and at gunpoint by, you know, more than 30 terrorists with automatic weapons, that the notion of conducting an attack against that, well, if we look back, it may have saved more than lives, more than the 331 lives, or if maybe fewer lives would have been lost if they had done that. They say that's sort of an impossible mass to engage in now, that nothing like this had ever happened in the history of modern policing. And the notion of rushing with gunmen into a gunfight with children in the midst of it would have been madness, and that they would have been charged with negligence had they done that too.
Would the adult hostages have had any impact if they tried to organize some sort of uprising before the bombs were rigged?
Well, most of the men were killed on the first day, and the terrorists took the immediate upper hand psychologically by letting everyone know that if there is an act of resistance, that we will kill children to punish that act. And I think this essentially paralyzed almost all open defiance.
You have to. It's hard to imagine what went through the minds of the people who were in there, especially the children. I'm assuming there's a lot of post-traumatic stress that has been a result of this.
Probably for the entire town. You know, one of the things that we found so amazing, and I'm sure CJ finds the exact same thing, is these people, when they tell you what happened during those 3 days, when they relive that horror, which is just unimaginable for us, they are so sincere and so thoughtful. They paint pictures of those 3 days. They can tell you stories, the colors of the uniforms of the terrorists, the masks, the colors of their eyes, the detail and the sort of clarity that they have when they relive this unspeakable horror is an amazing thing to hear.
And then some of the stories they tell you. One of the women had to choose between her children. Another had chose to stay with her older child and gave her infant to Ruslan Aushev. But these people,
and that woman,
but having to pick between your kids.
Yes. That woman who sent out her baby, Leonard, she died, and so did her older child.
And, you know, Aushev carried out the last baby himself. You know, a woman could not bear to leave her older child, and Aushev walked out with that child. I mean, you know, one of the women in our documentary had to make the choice, and, you know, she was that child lived. So there were some stories. I think that there are kind of two Beslans. We actually brought one of the young women in who helps tell our story, Daria Fadieva, whose sister was a hostage. We brought her into New York when the film had appeared at Tribeca. And, you know, the resilience is remarkable, but it's just under the surface. And, you know, these are people with a tremendous sense of purpose and mission, the survivors, but it's just under the surface. And they're still dealing with severe injuries and mental trauma. I don't think there's enough psychological help in there by any stretch of the imagination to help them deal with the post-traumatic stress that they must be going through.
And I'm sure even the people who are outside, Chris, what happened after the explosion on the third day? People must have felt totally impotent.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the short answer is what happened was chaos. The roof, burst, and then it burst again about 22 seconds later. And within a minute, everyone, I think, realized this was it, and the gunfire just began to rise and rise. And the explosions had blown out all of the windows in the gym, and this created, for the first time, avenues of escape. And many of the less injured or stronger people ran away on their own, but the terrorists then herded people to the cafeteria over the course of the next hour or so, where they were going to make one of their last stands. And the Russians attacked in time, but not immediately. The approaches to the school were too open, and there are too many terrorists shooting, and they were unable to advance and breach the school for more than an hour. They entered the school in several different places over the course of the afternoon, and the people of Beslan were behind them. I mean, right, even among them, among the Spetsnaz soldiers as they went in. They were carrying stretchers. Eventually, they were actually fighting the fires with the fire trucks because the firemen didn't do a very good job on that score. And so there was this chaos, but there was not, there was, of course, a sense of complete frustration and horror, but many people, many hundreds of people, were in motion trying to do what they could.
The gun battle went on for, what, Joe, 10 hours? It, you know, hour after hour. And the situation was so complicated because the townspeople in Beslan, were some of them were wearing camouflage gear and armed. And so, you know, who was the enemy? It was a very hard process to discern.
When you interviewed two members of the Russian Special Forces, they wore masks. Why?
I think they were as concerned about their bosses, their commanders, knowing that they cooperated and talked with us as they were about any other issue. But that was particularly what they were concerned about.
Chris, you see all of this as a legacy of the Soviet sensibility? Have things changed all that much?
Well, it's tough to pin this directly on the Soviet Union.
No, I just mean the way authorities used to whitewash incidents, blame everybody else, punish people who spoke out.
Well, I think that would certainly be the prevailing sentiment in Beslan, that there was a failure on many levels, and there's not a lot of interest in examining that failure. There has been some of the investigations have come to some conclusions that are getting nearer to the truth slowly, but they certainly are not that close to the truth yet. And there's certainly a lot of areas that are unexplored. And there is, as you suggest, a sense among the people down there that this is business as usual.
Thank you all so much for being with us. C.J. Chivers, his article, The School, appears in the June issue of Esquire magazine. Joe Haldeman and Susan Zirinsky, their film 3 Days in September, which was at the Tribeca Film Festival, will be available on television on Showtime at 8:30. On this coming Thursday, May 25th. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.